there are those who believe that although the mass of a neutrino is small, it's real. I'm reasonably sure that photons have an extremely small amount of mass. A number of the NASA projects with these so-called solar sails talk about solar mass striking the sail and giving you some of the thrust. So when you've got a solar sail on a spacecraft, and that experiment's already been done, and you get thrust out of it, is it the solar wind physical particles striking the sail, or is it the solar optical energy striking the sail, giving you thrust? I think the answer is both. I'm not sure which one dominates, but I don't think a photon is thoroughly massless, because if it was thoroughly massless, I don't think there would be the so-called photoelectric effect for which Einstein got his first Nobel Prize. That's my first impression on this. I'm not a pro in this area. We're all slowly learning.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
I've heard from you, Dick, and from Eric, just a few months ago, the statement when we were talking about photons and about light and the speed of light. And I was trying to say that electromagnetic waves bend because of its mass. The statement was like that. Photon does not have a mass. It is pure energy. And the second statement was, electromagnetic wave does not have a mass. It's a pure energy. Back to you.
Okay, a number of the good optical telescopes, Hubble among others, have seen gravity lensing effects. In other words, the light waves that are leaving an extremely far galaxy, when they go by a galaxy that's midway between that far galaxy and us, they get bent around that galaxy. You see the galaxy as a great big ring of galaxy optically around that more nearby galaxy. So light waves definitely do get bent by the so-called gravity lensing effect. Also, when the confirmation of Einstein's theories were, the very first confirmation is that you carefully measured the orbit of Mercury going around the Sun, and when Mercury peeks out from behind the Sun, so to speak, in its known orbit, and you measure the timing of when you first see Mercury, you are literally measuring the amount of bending of the light wave coming from Mercury, grazing by the Sun's surface, coming to the Earth. So because of those two experiments of gravity lensing effect, I don't think you can say photons and radio waves are thoroughly massless. I think the photons of a radio wave and a photon of a light wave, they're both photons, they just have a different amount of energy, or you could say a different amount of frequency, E equals H nu, if you know what I mean. But there is a finite amount of mass there, I believe, because they both experience bending effect, which is gravity-caused bending effect, not dielectric lensing effect. It's really gravity-caused bending effect. Over to you, Wesley, K2RIW.
K22, QAQ with a comment.
Here's where I have a problem, okay? I'd love to hear from Eric and Van. Where I have a problem. I was trying to make a radical theory, or at least go to the theory from 1950s from Europe, when I was taught that the photons and the radio waves, they do have a mass, and they compared it to sand blasting. You have one particle of sand, and you have billions of them. The mass actually adds. The length wave of the radio waves, the longer the wave, the more amount of the joint mass is traveling. That's why the wave bends. The longer the wave, the better the ability to bend. At that time, I was criticized by you and by Eric for the fact that I'm completely wrong. Now I can hear that photons do have and do bend. At that point, I may say, electromagnetic waves do have mass and do bend. And do exist. Question, Dick.
Yeah, there's going to be Glenn and John in that area, and that order. We're all feeling our way on this one, Wesley. And so we may have expressed strong opinions, and we may have been saying you're wrong. It may have sounded like we're saying you're wrong. I think we're all wrong, because we're all feeling our way on this one. And so my reading leads me to believe that all of these waves, all of these particles, all of these things have an amount of mass. It may be extremely small or extremely large by comparison, but I think there's mass there. That's my belief. Glenn, lead us out of the dark here, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Well, I think the answer to this one goes back to somewhere around 1910, and your wording for taking us into the light is really the right way to explain this, is that, you know, when you're looking at two different models, there's a wave model and there's a quantum model, and they're treated in two different ways. Like when light is traveling through a vacuum, it's non-luminant. In other words, it doesn't light anything until it strikes a mass. So if you've got an electromagnetic light wave running through light, you know, it's like if you take a flashlight and there's no clouds or anything out, and you point that flashlight in a direction, you won't see the beam unless it intersects with something in between. So at that point, it's just a wave. At that where the wave is not intersecting or not messing with any mass anyplace, you won't see anything visible in the light. Let me let it drop for a second. So when light is traveling through space in a vacuum and there's no mass involved, the energy is still moving in an electromagnetic wave at that point, and at that point there's no mass that we can detect anywhere or nothing perceivable because there's no mass in a vacuum. And the light's just, but we know that the wave travels through it. So there, no mass. Now, on the other hand, once you have a surface and that electromagnetic light wave strikes that surface, now we have a quantum model. And we can say, okay, now we can see luminescence. We'll see the light reflect. Some will be absorbed. Some will illuminate at that point. There'll be light. You can visually see it now because the electromagnetic wave has come in contact with a mass. Now you can use a quantum model and look at a photon, and then you can convert the energy to mass and determine luminescence. So there are really two different models here. I'm going to pass it back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I'm sorry, that's very smart what you said. I love it. That means that electromagnetic wave at the length of 160 meters is illuminating the particles of atmosphere, and that's why it's bending. Is that true, Glenn?
Dick, do I have it?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'm not, you know, a super expert here at, you know, space and what actually goes on there, but here's where, notice what I'm going to say, I'm going to take a swag at it kind of a thing, that when light is an electromagnetic wave and it moves through different mediums, in other words, it comes in contact with masses, like there's gases and things involved in space, and when that light goes through that surface, now it's in contact with masses again. And that's how we detect it, because that's when it's visible light and we can see it. So will that once that electromagnetic light wave hits other mass, sure, now it can be, you know, because we're seeing it illuminated on a mass, that mass can be affected by gravity. So if we see a bend associated to the masses that light is reflecting off at that distance, I'm sure you could see a bend. So what we're actually looking at, the visible light, is the electromagnetic light wave coming in contact with masses that are creating visible light that we can view. Hopefully that makes a little bit more sense, and I'm going to pass it back to Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, let me challenge you a little bit on that one, Glenn. I've got an asteroid traveling at some ridiculously high velocity, going through the vacuum of space, heading for Earth. As it travels through the vacuum of space, it has some minor perturbations in its orbit because of local gravity fields of some planet that it passes by. But as it travel through space, a so-called massless medium. It doesn't get slowed down. It's not having any impacts. It's not giving off any light, whatever. Then this asteroid starts striking the Earth's atmosphere, and you start seeing heating effects and whatever. By the same token, why couldn't a light wave traveling through space have the same amount of mass it normally has, but there's nothing there for it to react on? Once it starts hitting the atmosphere, depending on the nature of the aerosols, the molecules, or whatever it hits, it has some kind of a reaction. And then when it comes down to your photoelectric detecting device, it's now impacting a real chunk of material and giving you a response. You made it sound like through the vacuum it has no mass, and when it strikes something it suddenly has mass. Couldn't it continuously have mass, and you only sense that mass when it strikes something? Back to you, Glenn, KQLAW.
Well, from my understanding, I would have to say no, and this is the reason why I would have to say no. If I look at the electromagnetic wave spectrum and how we calculate it, and we determine the size, the volume, and the dimension of electromagnetic wave, there's no mass in that equation anywhere. So that's my first area when I'm saying, when I'm talking about the wave part, that certainly there's no mass there. Now, if there's going to be something in light that's traveling through space that has a mass, then it would be visible through space. But if you take a light source and you put it off on the side and shine it through a vacuum with nothing to intersect on, there's no visible light. In other words, you won't see that light beam until you walk into it or, you know, give it, you have to get in its way. If somebody points through a vacuum, a flashlight, a laser beam, whatever it is, you can walk right into it and not realize it until you're actually intersecting it and right in the middle of it. So at that point, there's no particles, there's no visible light as it's going through the vacuum. That's my second proof. The third proof is when I look at a quantum model, what is quantum mechanics? What is the photon? The photon is the energy converted to mass creating luminescence. In those cases, I'm taking energy, acting on a mass, and giving me light. So in all three of those observations, the electromagnetic wave and the mass are treated completely separate in all of those models, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
When you do light calculations, yes, you don't use mass because that's the way we set up those particular equations. I suspect there are ways you could include mass. Let me give you a simpler example. I got two billiard balls on my billiard table about to strike each other. At the instant they strike, the forces are huge. Yes, I could try to calculate what's going to happen by F equals MA, force equals mass times acceleration. But to calculate the instantaneous force at the impact of two billiard balls, very difficult. You give up and go to another kind of mathematics, and you say momentum is conserved. Momentum is MV. And so I could call MV a kind of momentum energy. That white billiard ball has a certain amount of momentum energy. It's about to strike your eight ball, and because momentum is conserved, I can figure out what went on. So by taking the momentum M energy, which is a product of M and V, and I don't have to know the exact amount of M or the exact amount of V. I just know what the product is. And I know before the impact what was the product, and after the impact I know what the product is. So I could come up with a whole set of mathematics for your billiard table that doesn't necessarily use mass. That doesn't mean mass is not there. So just because I come up with a set of mathematics for light waves in space which don't use mass, that doesn't necessarily mean mass is not there. Am I naive in that one? Back to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Well, it's not a matter of being naive. I think what's going on here is that, in other words, all the theorems basically talk about mass when there's luminescence. In vacuum, there's no luminescence. So where's the mass? I mean, you can take a particle, of any atom, and you can accelerate it, and how we know that we're accelerating it is by its visible light. That's how we detect it. Or its electromagnet. We can look at its electromagnetic stream, and we can have it intersect that particle, hit something, or whatever. But the issue is that if you have an electromagnetic light wave and there's any mass, there's usually luminescence. And in other words, like when we shine light as an electromagnetic wave from a laser source, a light beam, if there's fog or an atmosphere, we see the trail. You can see the mass in between. But when you put a vacuum there, there's no more luminescence. So here again, you know, how do you answer that one? Where's the mass, Dick? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Dick, I'm sorry. Let me get it. It looks like Glenn is saying there is a potential, but there is no value to the potential. When it strikes my pocket, all of a sudden, there is a physical 100 bucks in it. But the question is, the potential is not described of its ability to impact my pocket. You never get to the point how the energy from the photon is ever able to actually get to the mass, and then all of a sudden, when it goes again to the vacuum, it is simply throwing out the mass. I mean, I don't understand that, Dick.
Can I answer that one, Dick?
Yeah, I'm going to ask a question to Glenn right now. I've got a radiometer in front of me, let's assume. It's one of these four-bladed things inside of a glass bulb, and one side of each one of the blades is black and the other side is silver. I shine light on it. The light impacts the black sides, visibly causes heating, obvious by the fact that the radiometer turns. What at the molecular level is taking place in your mind, Glenn, so that my light wave goes through that glass, there's a problem, but what is that light wave doing at the molecular level to the surface of that blackened material to create heating of those molecules? How does the light wave create that heating at the molecular level? Over to you, Glenn.
WS2N.
Dick, do you want to recognize him first?
Glenn, go ahead with that question first.
See, the problem with this one is I know mathematically how to show this. How to describe it in English is going to take me a little bit of thinking here. So I'm going to take a swag at this one again. And what's actually happening here is that the electromagnetic wave does not have the photon. It's the electromagnetic wave is just the wave that goes through vacuum. Now you have a surface, and when it strikes the surface, I can build a quantum model. And inside the quantum model, we have a photon. So what we're doing is we're taking a mass, and that mass will be struck by an electromagnetic wave in the frequency of light. Now, at the frequency of that energy, when it strikes that mass, okay, all different masses have different properties. Some masses, like shiny aluminums, are going to have a certain reaction. The darker materials, or the black body materials, will have a different reaction, which will give you a lower frequency effect, which will where you won't be able to see as much visible light, but give you more heat. So in other words, there's more absorption taking place because of the material itself. The shinier materials will have a more reflective effect at which time they hit. Now those things have a ratings of what's called emissivity. And emissivity is a black body experiment where the blacks are the darkest, in other words, they convert most of the energy to heat, and the emissivities that are at higher levels are going to have more reflection. Now, inside that response, mathematically, I'm trying to put the numbers to that and try to explain it. It's the energy that's going to, and the material. So in other words, when that energy strikes the material, there's going to be an effect. In other words, it's like electrical energy in a piezoelectric. If you would put it through a coil, one time you're going to get sound. You put it into a light bulb, you're going to get light. So it's the frequency of the energy and the materials into reaction. That's the best swag I can give it to you in English, Dick.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
You may also say, I'm sorry, but it's so hot. You may also say that the mass of the large amount of photons is actually frictioning with the mass of the dark surface, because it's not able to reflect. So that might be also the explanation. I'm sorry, I'm not going to interrupt any longer.
Yeah, we're all seeking a way of understanding this. Now, let me throw one other thing at you that might help. We all know that a light wave or a radio wave striking a shiny metallic surface, angle of incidence equals angle of reflection. It's a given. We've seen the experiment. We accept that. Now let me take a vertically polarized light wave at something like a 45 degree angle, striking a metallic surface. I made it vertically polarized intentionally because I want to excite the Brewster angle effect. And let me make this dielectric material. Yeah, I know that it works better with dielectric material. So when you get angle of incidence going into angle of reflection off of a dielectric material, and by Snell's law, you know exactly how much energy is going to reflect. But why is there a Brewster angle effect? Those individual molecules of your dielectric material on near the surface get excited by that wave. They physically move because of that incoming wave. They get absorption and re-radiation. By absorption, I mean they absorb energy, and although they're locked in a matrix and they can only wiggle back and forth, they wiggle back and forth in a particular direction depending on the polarization and the angle of incidence of the incoming wave. The wave that reflects off of that surface, if it was a vertically polarized wave, you get a null at that angle because they're wiggling back and forth in the direction of propagation of the reflected wave, and you cannot propagate a wave if the E field is parallel to the direction. That's the explanation for the Brewster angle nulling, if you know what I mean. So you literally are physically moving those molecules on the surface of the dielectric material because of the incoming wave. That sounds like something that was created by a mass.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I guarantee there's a lot more to it. Eric, maybe you can clear this up a little bit. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
I have the explanation for that, Dick. It's in there.
Eric first and then Glenn in that order. Go ahead, Eric.
All right, let me throw this at you, okay? Let's say, you know, photons have no mass, but they have momentum, okay? So, the general equation that Einstein worked with is really E squared equals M squared times C to the fourth, okay? In the case of the photon, M is equal to zero. So, and then the more complete answer is E squared M squared times C to the fourth plus P squared times C to the square, right? P being the photon. So, if M equals zero equals P times C, or P equals E over C. All right, now, if you take it with the particle at rest, mass is equal to zero, no momentum. Therefore, you wind up with E equals MC squared. All right, let me let it drop for a second. So, what we do is we actually, and this is the way I understand it, who was it? Max Planck. When he described what, I think he was working, on black body radiation and suggested that energy and electromagnetic waves could only be released in packets of energy, and this was in, 1901, I think it was. So we call these packet energy elements. By the way, this goes back to the conversation that we were having the other day about weak forces and strong forces. And what it wound up being was the word quanta, or single quantum, which was to mean particles or amounts of different quantities, which includes electricity. So Einstein went further deeper than that by suggesting that electromagnetic waves could only exist in these discrete wave packets. He called the wave packets the light quantum, and the name photon was derived from the Greek word for light. So, take it from there.
You did say that a light wave has momentum. And since in simplistic Newtonian terms, momentum is M times V, and we think we know the V, although the M is going to be very small, I think it might not be zero. But I'm being very simplistic here. Glenn says he can explain it all. Go ahead, Glenn.
NWS2N. Okay, my explanation, let me just see if I have it for a second. Okay, the electromagnetic wave from a vacuum is moving along, at that point, no mass. Now, it comes in contact with a mass, as Eric is explaining, with the equation. Now, when you build a quantum model, okay, in other words, and you start looking at the mass for momentum, because in other words, in order to have a momentum, you must have a mass, because if there's no mass, there's no momentum. That's how the quantum model is built, and it's around that. So when the electromagnetic wave, okay, hits a material or a particle at this particular point, the initial mass point of the particle is its mass. Now you apply the energy to the mass, and you start building the quantum model, and you can determine from the amount of energy that strikes the first particle to the amount of energy that's absorbed to energy that's reflected inside the model, and you build it from there. And that's how the quantum model works. So the photon energy is only recognized at the time that the electromagnetic wave comes in contact with the mass of the particle. So the particle is the mass at which it's illuminating or reflecting off of, which has an emissivity. And a certain amount of that will be either absorbed into heat or reflected, and or a little bit of both in most cases. But here again, keep in mind that the mass that we're talking about in the quantum model, of which the photon is part of the model, is the initial mass of the item at which the electromagnetic wave is striking. So in other words, when the electromagnetic wave is in space, the electromagnetic wave has geometry, but no mass or momentum. It has a velocity, but no momentum. Isn't that interesting? But when it strikes the object, or the mass, the particle, at that point, then we build the quantum model, we develop the photon, determine the energy that's now combined between the mass, the momentum, and the energy at that point. Does that make more sense? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Oh, and by the way, the energy and momentum of a photon depend upon its frequency or inversely its wavelength, whichever way you want to look at it.
Right on.
Now, one of the questions Wesley asked, maybe it was last week, explain to me why there is a maximum usable frequency. Why does the ionosphere favor lower frequencies, and as you go to higher frequencies, it stops? We call it reflection. It's really a kind of a refraction going on. But why does the atmosphere become more transparent as you go higher in frequency? I think you can say that the photons of a higher frequency wave have more energy. Why do the more energetic radio waves striking the ionosphere no longer get affected by it? Who wants to pick that one up?
I'll start with the basics.
Go ahead, Glenn.
And WS Glenn is trying to get through.
If you want to recognize?
Yeah, Paul wants to ask a question, so when we give an answer, we're going to answer all of them at once. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, I might have been doubling with everybody. I tried the input on Selvin here, but I've been trying that. I was under the impression the photons were both, and proven that they were both. They act as a wave and also have mass, like a particle. And Glenn's explanation of the photon moving through space, everything's black, that's very true. That's a very good explanation. You know, the astronauts, when they're in space, they look around, they see black all over until they look at the if he's doing an AVA, he sees black until he looks at the spacecraft or his glove, and then he sees a reflection. When they went to the moon, those half a dozen flights, everywhere they walk around on the moon, it was always daytime on the moon when they went. But they looked up in space, and everything was black, and they wouldn't see any kind of color or anything else until they looked at the surface or the spacecraft or each other. So that shows that it's really a wave. But then they did some experiment with a slit. Let me drop it. And I'm not going to try to explain it, but they have a slit in like a wall, and they put two slits actually, and they aim a light at it, and it's supposed to act a certain way, and it to prove that it's either a wave or a particle. And when they look behind the slit, the reflection, when they take measurements of light, it acts as a particle. The detection that they make shows that it was a particle. I mean, this was done like, what, 80 years ago or something. It was a long, long time ago. And that's what gave them the idea that it's both really a particle and a wave. One with mass and one without mass. Back to you, WS-20.
Intervention responding to the subject.
Somebody's throwing an event at you. I mean, if a photon had mass, it wouldn't move at exactly the speed of light in a vacuum, would it?
Paul, when you come back, you can go on the 2585. You come through louder when you do that, and we were hearing you. And by the way, I think you've got it backwards. The dual slit experiment strongly indicated that the light was a wave, not a particle. You can send light very carefully, one particle, one photon at a time, to a dual slit experiment, a dual slit aperture. And you'll get an interferometry pattern on the screen beyond the dual slit. So even though you're sending one photon at a time, you get the classic interferometry pattern showing that it behaves as a wave during that experiment. I guess, Eric, go ahead, Eric.
Can I pick it up?
Go ahead.
I think one of the problems here is that, you know, it's the way that this is taught. If you do the math, it becomes very, very obvious. But the way it's explained sometimes is just really, really poor. In an electromagnetic wave, there is no mass. Okay? And I mean, you do all the equations, it's very, very obvious. Now, when we talk about light, on the other hand, the light that's practical light, light that we all live with, is luminescent light. It's what's visible, the light that your eye detects. This is both a wave and a mass. The mass is what's illuminating. It's visible light. You can see it. So there has to be obviously an electromagnetic wave because there's energy being absorbed. You're seeing luminescence, and there's energy being reflected, and there's heat being developed. So we use the quantum model at the time of luminescence of whatever the electromagnetic light is hitting. So once it strikes a mass and it becomes luminescent, at that point, now we can use a quantum model, and we can determine the amount of energy being absorbed, the amount of luminescence, the amount of heat being dissipated, and the amount being reflected. So that's the beauty about the quantum model and the photon. The photon, but we can't determine the energy and the mass until the two unite. So when it's in a vacuum, the electromagnetic wave just keeps on going along its merry way following inverse square law. Once it comes into contact with particles, then we can build a quantum model because now we have a mass we can deal with, and we can determine how much energy goes in and how much luminescence and everything else. K2RIW, KC2QIQ. I know I didn't answer the question about the ionosphere, but I can get to that next.
Can I have it?
Yeah, there's something bothering me, Glenn, and that is you said that when you look at the mathematics, it's obvious. Well, there's two things wrong with that. To some of us, it's not that obvious. And second of all, the mathematics is not the absolute truth. The so-called mathematics is somebody's model of what he thinks is going on. He comes up with mathematics that matches the observed performance most of the time. An awful lot of the mathematics that has ever been derived for any situation really is a model that works for the time being until you get deeper into it. So to think that the mathematics tells you the whole story, I'm a little worried about that one. Go ahead, Wesley.
That was a good one. When I was a young one, there was a mathematical model that was presented to me by my professor for mathematics, who actually was able to prove mathematically that 2 plus 2 is not 4. Now, you still guys, all of you, didn't deliver undeniable explanation of the fact of the unity of photon with mass. That means, what kind of tools the pure energy with no mass, like a ghost, have to affect that mass and create mechanical or thermal or electromechanical effect in it, which would be actually a process. That's what I do not understand. Dick?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how to even ask that one. But when it comes to Wesley's earlier question of the ionosphere versus wavelength and maximum usable frequency is my word for it, Glenn has an explanation on that. Let's hear it.
Well, I have my explanation, and this is going to be from the basic level. You know, it's going back to, okay, we have an electromagnetic wave. The ionosphere has a mass. It's a medium. And a certain amount of that energy, just like light going through space, the electromagnetic wave, here again, is the same. Now, as the electromagnetic wave is moving through space, in following inverse square law, it comes in contact with ionosphere. And ionosphere is made up of particles, and a lot of it being oxygen. And when it hits these oxygen molecules and other parts that are built up into it as well, but mainly it's going to start knocking off electrons and ionizing. And you'll see that also from space with light has this effect on it as well. But what's basically happening is that as the frequency or the wavelength of the signal increases, there's a certain amount of reflection coefficient. Now, from this point on, Dick, I think you can probably handle it a whole heck of a lot better than I can, but pretty much what's happening is the electromagnetic wave is coming in contact with the mass of the ionosphere, the particles of the ionosphere. Back to you, K2RAW, KC2QIQ.
I'm going to take exception to what you just said. Yes, when the Hopf experiment puts out a huge amount of power flux density, watts per square meter, or effective isotropic radiated power, it does create some ionization. But the ionosphere that you and I care about, 99.99% of it, was created not by our radio wave, but by what the sun is doing. The ultraviolet and the solar wind hitting that upper layer of 100 kilometers up creates ionized particles. The ionosphere is a plasma. It has separated electrons and separated nucleuses of those molecules. They are charged particles. So the ionosphere is a plasma, which means it is made up of charged particles, and a certain percentage of those particles have been ionized. Now, once you've got that ionosphere, which has been created by something other than your and my radio wave, now my radio wave is either at 80 meters and appears to reflect, or it's at 10 gigahertz and appears to go to consider the ionosphere completely transparent. What ain't clear, which is one of Wesley's earlier questions, is how come the ionosphere is inert to the higher frequency and active at the lower frequency? And at first you said you had an explanation for that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Well, first thing is this. If you have an electromagnetic wave and one oxygen atom kicks off one electron and becomes electrically higher in charge at that point, because, okay, is that ionization? I would say it is. Now, granted, when you take something like a harp and you do it in a mass level, you can say, yes, that's, that's a much, much higher, or the sun and what it's capable of, yes, it's much higher levels. But will just a simple electromagnetic wave do it on a much, much tinier scale? Yeah, it will. It'll have a small effect on it. Granted, nothing near that's going to affect propagation, but let me let it drop for a second.
That's not true. I may say I might be wrong. The 160 meters radio wave, or 80 meters radio wave, is in great percentage or almost completely reflected. Enter again.
Okay, so at a particle level, what we're basically saying is that at the lower frequency range, less energy is absorbed and more is reflected. And at the higher frequencies, more energy is being absorbed in the material and, you know, than being reflected. Now, is that 100% truth or not? I'm not completely sure, Dick. I'm going to kick this one over to you, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
My friends in the moon bounce world intentionally go to higher frequencies for moon bounce for two reasons. One, their antennas of finite size have more directivity. You and I call it gain. They call it less beamwidth, and more of the energy is hitting the moon. So they go to higher frequencies for two reasons. One, the antenna gives them more performance. Number two, the ionosphere is transparent. You go to a high enough frequency, the signal goes roaring through that ionosphere and says nothing is there. You go to a low enough frequency, like 80 meters, you try to do moon bounce at 80 meters, and you'll be reflecting off the ionosphere, not off the moon. So we're not quite sure yet what's going on here. And 2 weeks ago, we discovered that we made the guess, at least I made the guess, that the Hopf experiment takes what little bit of ionosphere is there, heats it. The heating process means that those molecules are moving faster. When they're moving faster, they impact each other with greater velocity and create more ionization. So the ionization process of a Hopf experiment is not because of some kind of resonance going on at that frequency. Hopf can work at any frequency you like, just put out enough power. So it's taking what little bit of ionosphere is there and heating it. So lower frequencies, the ionosphere is active. Higher frequency, the ionosphere is transparent. Why? At the molecular level, I'm having trouble with that one. Try one more time, Glenn. K2RIW, KC2QIQ. You know what I mean.
Yeah, and here again, this is just a guess on my part. I'm just thinking here that what's really happening is that the lower frequency or longer wavelength, just in terms of area, with respect to the ionosphere, has more surface to reflect. Where when you take a higher frequency, narrower wavelength, and you beam it through it, you're using a smaller cross-section so that there's not necessarily that it's transparent, but much less reflection off of it. So in other words, if you're cutting through a cross-section with high directivity in a small beam pattern, as opposed to a much, much wider surface area at lower frequency and longer wavelength, it has more ability to reflect. But there again, that's just a guess on my part, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
The evidence is opposite on that one. There's nothing stopping me from taking a 10 gig signal, and I don't have to put it into a high gain antenna where it's a narrow pencil beam piercing through the ionosphere. I can use an isotropic 10 gig antenna. I can smear that 10 gig signal, the same number of watts of it as your 80 meter dipole, same number of watts per square meter. I can smear an extremely wide 10 gig signal onto that ionosphere. Every bit of that wide 10 gig signal will go roaring through that ionosphere, and it will say nothing is there. Back to you, Glenn.
Well, here again, then if it's not, you know, just a cross-sectional area, then it has to be that the wavelength of the electromagnetic energy is fitting between the particles. So in other words, there has to be a certain amount of particle spacing or density to the ionosphere for the surface area for it to interreact. And at higher frequency, it just so happens that the wavelength of the electromagnetic energy is not intersecting enough of that mass to do anything, where at lower frequencies, it's covering maybe more area and more mass. but here again, it has to eventually work out to some kind of electromagnetic geometry to whatever the positioning of that mass is that's in the ionosphere. Back to you, Dick.
Can I say it a different way for you?
About the mass, and that would be actually mass of the electromagnetic waves. My assumption is that from this discussion I could understand that the longer the wave, the more part the mass the wave carries on. I mean, I don't understand. I was trying to, maybe John would be able to help me out to ask this question. What kind of tools or means or mechanism does the light or photon or electromagnetic wave has to create mechanical or thermal reaction into the atmosphere or any other mass?
Dick? Yeah, Eric recognized, Wesley recognized, Glenn, I've got another exception to what you just said. You said that as you go to a higher frequency where the wavelength is shorter, you now have too small a wave that can squeeze in between the molecules of the ionosphere and go roaring through. I'm going to give you an example that's the opposite of that again. When many of these 10 gig signal guys do cloud bounce, what do they discover? The individual aerosol molecules, aerosol particles of a cloud reflects more and more as you go to higher and higher frequencies. Their explanation is that as you go to too lower frequency where the wavelength is big enough, the individual aerosol particles are too small a fraction of a wavelength in diameter or circumference, you can look at it either way, in order to get enough excitation and re-radiation. Those individual aerosol particles of a cloud are getting to be a big enough fraction of a wavelength that will give you significant reflection at higher frequencies. You can get beautiful cloud reflection at 10 gigs. At 1 gig, you almost can never find it. I know that Eric wants to clear this up. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, but Dick, one quick thing here. When you're talking about the composition of a cloud and the material that it's made of, as opposed to the ionosphere is highly diluted, and it's mainly oxygen molecules. The clouds its composition is completely different material. So it's apples and oranges. Back to you.
Why are there no nitrogen molecules in the ionosphere?
I'm not convinced that there isn't, but the density of them is extremely light because of the gravitational effect on what makes up the different layers of the atmosphere. But when you get up there, apparently the majority of what makes up the ionosphere, as I'm aware, is predominantly oxygen.
You've got it, Eric.
All right, well, what you're really talking about is refraction, okay? I think I got another way to put it. When you send a radio wave into the ionosphere, okay, the electric field of the wave is going to force the electrons in the ionosphere to oscillate at the same frequency as that wave that you're sending in. Okay, some of that radio frequency energy is going to be given up and cause this resonant oscillation. These oscillating electrons will then either be lost or re-radiated as the original wave energy. So it's kind of like a mirror in that sense. And so you get refraction when the collision frequency of the ionosphere is less than the radio frequency, so that the electron density in the ionosphere is great enough, you get this mechanism of refraction. And if it's not, or if the transmitted frequency is higher than what they call the plasma frequency of the ionosphere, the electrons can't follow that wave front fast enough, and they don't get re-radiated. And that's a simple way of looking at it without going into what the actual component of the ionosphere is in terms of whether it's oxygen molecule, nitrogen molecule, hydrogen molecules, which you've got all of those components and more.
If the electrons are being radiated or not radiated, electrons do have a mass and to exchange.
You use the word resonance of the ionosphere particles. I'm having problems with that. Oxygen, nitrogen, whatever, all of those molecules, their first real resonance point is somewhere around 60 gigahertz. So
let's call it resonant oscillations. They follow the frequency of what's going up there, okay? Not resonant as in tuned circuit.
Okay. So you basically said the electrons can't move fast enough to get any real action at the higher frequency where the ionosphere is apparently transparent. So only the lower frequencies have the time per cycle to move those electrons. Is that sort of what you're saying, Eric? Go ahead.
So to speak, because at different times of the day, the MUP changes, and it really all depends upon the density of free electrons that are moving in the ionosphere at that particular point in time. The more dense it is, the higher the frequency you can move. The less dense it is, the less high frequencies you can do. You can reflect back.
The Long Island Radio Radio.
No, it's that way.
Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Okay. As I have a more dense ionosphere, a higher level of ionization, that means the mean distance between ionized particles is smaller. When the mean distance between ionized particles is smaller, they will be effective, have an effect on higher frequency waves. That implies that the high frequency wave must be doing something to those ionized particles so that they in turn react with each other, bounce off each other or whatever, recombine with each other. So the mean distance between the ionosphere particles, ionized particles, seems to be the wavelength sensitive, frequency sensitive phenomena that gives you maximum usable frequency. Are we getting close on that one from your understanding, Eric? KQLIW?
From my visualizing point of view, yeah, I think so. I'm just surmising from what I know. I don't know if this is the actual explanation of it, but that's just what I visualize of it. And like a cutoff frequency is going to be a frequency that's below, less than that density of particle. And you know, we're also not talking about incidence of angle and that kind of stuff, because I mean, if we were talking about light, we would include all those things. But we're talking way lower frequencies than that, and you know, completely different kind of energy at this point. I mean, you want to get into the concept of, oh, the radio waves are smaller than the packing of the particles in the ionosphere. Yeah, you can go that way, but I think this is just simpler.
Okay, I can think of one other thing that's going to help. We all know that the angle that the radio wave hits the ionosphere is very critical. Do it at a grazing angle, you get a lot of reflection, what we call reflection. Do it at a steep angle, and the signal primarily goes roaring through. That tells me that the ionosphere, we call it reflection, I think it's really refraction. In other words, that grazing angle wave hits the ionosphere. By some magic, the portion of the wave that's higher up moves faster than the portion of the wave that's lower down. Therefore, the wave gets bent downward and comes back to the Earth's surface. We call that bounce, but it's really refraction. I think that's telling me that the ionosphere has a different dielectric constant as a function of frequency. Snell's law is what I think we're talking about here. So I'm beginning to think that the dielectric constant, which is a function of ionization level, number of ionized particles per cubic meter, is part of what we're going on here. If I could plot dielectric constant versus frequency, of the ionosphere. Would that give me a clue? I'm tossing the ball up in the air. K2LAW.
I think I have an answer for that.
Give it a go.
And to exchange. Guys, from what I've heard so far is that photon or electromagnetic wave does not have a mass. Okay. But when it impacts the air, it strikes the mass. So now it does have a mass. Now, the lower, closer to the Earth, the more density of mass that is being illuminated or united with that energy is there. Now, when we're talking about ionosphere, we're talking about very rare atmosphere. So then the illumination might be less, and the impact to the electromagnetic wave might be less. My understanding is that 160 meters wave transmitted from the transmitter at the level of ionosphere will have less difficulty to travel. Maybe the question that I should ask everybody is, if the 160 meters because the radio wave, because of impacting the mass and having the long the certain length of 160 meters is going nearby the vicinity and is bending nearby the vicinity of the Earth because of the gravity. Now, we're not talking about the pure radio wave, but we're talking about the radio wave with the mass on it. Question is that mass traveling with the wave, or is just staying and the wave is just being transferring that energy to another mass? Dick, pick up.
I'm going to go one step more basic than all of the discussion up till now. I think we're making a mistake when we discuss the word wavelength. We talk about the 80 meters, the 160 meters, the 20 meter band. We talk about wavelength. That is the length of wire that gives us a dipole resonance. When that wave at 20 meters or 80 meters is transmitted into space, at each instant of time, the wave has a certain number of volts per meter. If I give you a certain power out of the transmitter and a dipole pattern, I get the exact same number of volts per meter at 80 meters as 20 meters. Same number of volts per meter. The only thing that happens is the rate at which it changes from plus to minus. But once you transmit that wave in space, it has a certain pattern that you and I call antenna pattern, but what we call wavelength is the distance in the Z direction between two consecutive waves, but at any one particular point of analysis at one, any one, let me drop, at any one point of analysis, at any one instant of time, it has a given number of volts per meter. What you and I call wavelength, we picture the width of the wave as a wavelength as it goes through space. That's a nice mental picture.
Yes, it is, Dick.
I think that's dead wrong.
It has a geometry. Electromagnetic wave has geometry. Yes, it does.
Only in the Z direction does it have wavelength. In the X and Y direction, if I'm transmitting in the Z direction, it has no wavelength in the X and Y direction. Only in the Z direction, because of the rate of change, there's something you and I call wavelength. I go some number of meters in the Z direction before I go from positive to negative when I stop time, if you know what I mean. So it's got a wavelength in the Z direction. That's got nothing to do with the size of the wave going through this cloud of ionized particles. Over to you, Glenn.
Well, I believe that to be partially true.
Welcome
but
to the Long Island Mobile
here again,
Amateur Radio Club.
There is a geometry.
No, no,
it's you have the vacuum.
Link
you
active.
Have the radiation resistance of free space. You do have the length across the vacuum. So there is a definite geometry here. And the wave is moving depending on the pattern of the wave.